It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, April is National Volunteer Month, and Wisconsin ranks 8th in the country for the percentage of people donating their time.
First, we're talking about severe weather season. This weekend, severe storms and tornadoes killed 16 people in Oklahoma, Iowa, and Arkansas.
Before this weekend, reports stated that this year was the quietest tornado season so far on record. April, May, and June are the three biggest months nationwide for tornadoes. Here in Wisconsin, there was a statewide tornado drill last week. After such a long and harsh winter, we're wondering how much severe weather we can expect this spring.
Brian Olson is with us now. He's a meteorologist at WKOW in Madison. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much, Veronica. Rob, hi.
So obviously you, along with the nation, watching these severe tornadoes, this outbreak of severe weather, really seems like the first that we've seen this spring. Does this mean tornado season is here in earnest?
It's here in earnest at this point, yeah. I mean, as Rob mentioned, you know, kind of opening up there, since 1950, April 27th is the latest date to ever have an EF3 tornado be the first one of date for the year. So a very late start, and that in large part was due to the cold winter that we had. And basically what we've had happen or not happen so far is that really warm air coming up the plains and clashing with the cold air. It's really been the cold air in charge to this point so far.
So does this mean that the season as a whole is going to be shortened or just prolonged?
Well, it's going to be it's been delayed. And that's, I guess, the question is, certainly where they've had the severe weather, it's spring now, and they've sprung into, you know, summer awfully fast across the far southern plains. In fact, I just saw 100 degrees in Brownsville, Texas yesterday, a very quick start to the season. They saw their 100-degree mark, I believe, before I've seen one in Phoenix this year. Wow. Which is fairly rare. So all of our moisture for these severe storms, all of the heat and everything comes up from the Gulf of Mexico. And so, you know, in the springtime, a lot of times, as you mentioned, April, May, and June, the most volatile months. And that's in large part to a couple of things. One, we don't have the cold air gone yet, and the warm air is trying to come up at that same time. So as you get into that July and August, it's not that tornadoes can't occur, but you don't have that clash as readily available. And, you know, weather's all about change. So if you don't have the real cold and the real hot, the real dry and the real moist, then you're not going to have a real severe weather outbreak. Yesterday, we had everything kind of come into play. You had 30s behind this front. You had 80s and 90s ahead of that front, and you had a moist air mass coming up from the Gulf of Mexico ahead of it, compared with the dry air that's often coming off of the southwest, the desert, behind it. So it just all unfortunately came to fruition. I mean, this was fairly well forecast a couple of days in advance that there was a moderate to high risk of severe weather down in the parts that saw it.
Well, we've definitely still got the cooler air going on here in Wisconsin. We've got a lot of rain in the state for the next week. So what does that say about us for right now and the conditions that could create a tornado?
Right. So, you know, usually we're starting to get into that severe weather kind of regime here. And that's why we just had that tornado and severe weather awareness week last week. We try to make it just ahead of severe weather season. At this point, we're not really anywhere close to seeing those conditions that they have seen as close as southern Iowa yesterday. Mount Vernon, just to the north of Iowa City, saw a tornado yesterday. And we have such cool air here right now. A couple of reasons for that. Hudson Bay, even down to the northern lakes. As of April 10th, more than 50% of the Great Lakes was still ice. And usually it's down to 10% by then. 40% extra of ice. So that's a big percentage out there. And that has a big effect, you know, bodies of water that large, especially when you consider today, yesterday, our winds are out of the east and off of Lake Michigan. So, it's just plain chilly air. And while not very comfortable for us, I know there's a lot of kind of belly aching out there, and I'm among them. You know, I'd like the spring weather here too, but there is a positive sign there, and it's that we are not seeing what they're seeing just to our south.
Now, I'd always heard, and you can tell me if this is true or not, that the lakes in Wisconsin have a protective influence in keeping tornadoes at bay. I'm assuming the Great Lakes, and in Madison, I thought, hey, we're surrounded by Great Lakes, so we're fine.
Safe, right?
True or not?
Myth. That is a myth. No. Yeah, they are not large enough bodies of water to make a difference. If you've got an air mass is larger than any one lake. Now, if you get out toward the Atlantic Ocean, I grew up on Long Island, and out on Long Island, the storms would march eastward from New Jersey, hit a more maritime layer of air, and that maritime layer is influenced, it's influenced by an entire ocean of water, which changes the composition of the atmosphere, more than a mile up very easily. And that has an influence. But something as small as, Mendota and Monona, not a chance, unfortunately. A lot of people have mentioned that in the past, and also mentioned things like, the mountains break it up, or the mounds, blue mounds, or, things like that. And then blue mounds happened back in the 80s. And, okay, we don't hear about that one too much
anymore. Barneveld,
Barneveld,
right. That was pretty extreme. The whole town flattened.
Right.
So I know in the past, some of the terms that used to be just meteorologists would use have come into the common vernacular, like the Fujita scale. And now, tell us where that is now. Are we still using that terminology?
We are. Yeah. In fact, now it's the enhanced Fujita scale. So basically what they did was they took a scale from F0 to F5, where F5, the worst tornadoes, used to be from 261 to 318 miles an hour. And now an EF5 is 200 miles an hour or larger. So they made it easier to get to that number five. And it's not a thing that was done for sensationalism's effect. It was done because the way that they are figuring out what does damage to normal structures that are built for you and for me, just, houses and things like that, they are destroyed at an EF5. So there's really no need to have an EF6 or a 7 when most homes, most things that are built are destroyed at that 200 mile an hour level and plus.
So it's based on the wind speed. It's not based on sort of the circumference of the tornado funnel. That's, I always thought it was sort of the how wide it was.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's particularly dangerous, of course, when you have, paths that are a quarter mile or a half mile wide. It's almost unfathomable for you to think about, taking a spot that's a half mile from you. We think of a tornado, just like we draw it, coming down to a point, and you've got to be really unlucky. And yes, you have to be unlucky, but when it's a half mile wide, and you've got 200 mile an hour, not just 200 mile an hour winds, but 200 mile an hour swirling winds, that's the particular danger. I mean, that's what's does so much damage so fast is take a hurricane. A hurricane will have winds in one direction as the storm is passing you. It will switch to another direction, but it is not a constant free-for-all, basically a swirling in one location at the same time.
Can you give us a sense of the general trend as far as tornadoes go in severe weather in Wisconsin, maybe the last 5-10 years?
Yeah. So first year I was here was the big year. And I started thinking, wow, is this normal? It was 2005, and there were a record 62 tornadoes in the state. We averaged 23. So 62 was really doing something. 38 is what we had in 2011. That was the fourth busiest year. So the 62 just crushed everything. 2011 was a very busy year. And then a couple of quieter years. 2012, only four. Can you guess why that may have been?
So that's not an El Nino year, was it?
It wasn't, but drought.
We
couldn't get rain in here, so, just tough to make anything happen. We just had really dry weather. And then last year, fairly tame year, 16 of them altogether, which is, within the realm of average, but a little bit below as we, and I believe six of them happen on one day to get us to that 16. So if I were to make some guesses about this spring, I would say a later start for sure. I mean, we're already to the later start, right? So I would say instead of April, May, June, we would be looking at from maybe late May through June and into July. I think, though, that we will probably have maybe average to slightly cooler than average weather, which would kind of help keep that severe weather down somewhat, if you're thinking that clash of the hot and humid versus, and the later we go, another thing that plays into having tornadoes is the jet stream. And what makes this so volatile a time of year is that in the winter and the early spring, you still have a lot of dynamics in the upper part of the atmosphere, a lot of energy up there. And in the summertime, all of those winds just kind of die out. They, you know, more of the doldrums as we get into the summertime. And so then you're just basically, without the dynamics, you're basing, you're trying to get those tornadoes based solely on what's happening at the ground, basically the heat versus the cold.
Gotcha. Well, thank you for catching us up. And it sounds like a later season, maybe milder. We'll have to see what happens.
I would say so. And light at the end of the tunnel here, I would say, as we get into next winter, it does look like strong signs of an El Nino, which would mean milder weather here. Doesn't say anything about, you know, more or less snow, but it certainly tends to mean a milder winter, which is good news to many people's ears after this winter.
Right. Well, that's perhaps some good news. Brian, thank you so much for joining
us. Thanks, Veronica.
We've been talking to Brian Olson, meteorologist at WKOW.
April is National Volunteer Month, and while the month may be coming to a close, opportunities for Wisconsinites to get involved around the state are not.
To fill us in on how to get involved and to make the case for why volunteering can make a difference, we've got Michael Van Ness with us. He's the director of Volunteer Wisconsin.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. How do you volunteer? What does it mean to you? What do you get out of it? What does it mean for your community? Call now at 800-642-1234. Share your volunteer experience at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Michael Van Ness, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, I'm sorry, it's actually Matthew.
Matthew Van Ness. I'm sorry, we had a typo in the script here, Matthew. We'll go with Matthew. Matthew henceforth. So what are some ways people can find out about where to volunteer?
Well, volunteers or people that want to volunteer can find opportunities in a variety of ways. One is the Volunteer Wisconsin website, and that's volunteerwisconsin.org. Another great way is to contact your local volunteer center if you have one in your area. They usually will have listings about what opportunities are available on their websites. Another places where people can go to search is like on community calendars. You can check the newspaper, church bulletins, and even just sometimes simple word of mouth.
And are we volunteers here in Wisconsin? Do we have a strong culture of volunteering?
Yes, we do. Wisconsin, we are very proud to say that Wisconsin is number 8 in the nation for volunteering. We have a very strong commitment to our communities, and it's reflected in the time and energy that Wisconsinites put into their communities.
What kind of response have you gotten in Volunteer Month this year?
Oh, it's a tremendous response. There are so many people doing things during the month of April for volunteer efforts. You know, anything from trying to, you know, even though the weather hasn't been cooperating all that greatly across the state, people are getting out doing yard work for the elderly or disabled. Starting to do walkathons, things like that, just to get out in the community and make their presence known.
You know, I think one thing that might occur to a lot of busy folks is, gosh, volunteering sounds nice and worthwhile, but nobody's got time for that. How do you have to make a big commitment, or can you make just a little bit of time on a regular basis?
It's really up to the individual. People that volunteer, you know, are very giving of their time. But we, you know, I understand that not everybody has a lot of time that they can give. But any time anybody is willing to spend in the for the betterment of their community is going to help their community, no matter how much time they spend. So if it's 1 hour here, 2 hours there, it's going to be great. But if individual, we do like to see people volunteer on a more regular basis. So they might, if those folks are interested in doing that, they might look at more ongoing types of activities.
And how do people find a good match for their talents and maybe their personalities?
Well, it really it depends on the individual. A person really should take stock of what they like to do and maybe look at a hobby or something that they're interested in and see if they can share. You know, somebody who likes to read would be a great tutor in many ways. Somebody who likes to be outside and work with their hands might be great for volunteering, like on those, you know, yard cleanup days, or, you know, helping build a house for Habitat for Humanity, those types of things.
how can you be a good volunteer? And I mean, like, getting to a place and finding out what the needs are, because one place might be really organized, have a volunteer program, another might not. How do you make yourself the ideal volunteer?
Well, like I said before, the ideal volunteer is really taking stock of what your capabilities are. A volunteer should also know their limits. Don't let, say, an organization ask too much of you. You should be able to, feel comfortable in what you're doing and not feel overtaxed or feel like you're spending too much time, because we don't want volunteers to feel burnt out. We want them to continue to volunteer, so that it's a long, it's a long process through the rest of their life.
Is there a model volunteer? Is it a certain age group or type of person?
No, there is no model volunteer. It's really, I think, attitude as to how a person wants to commit to their community or help out their community. I've seen volunteers that are 7 years old, just have a passion for, they want to help, somebody by, organizing a sock drive or something like that. And they're just as enthusiastic as the 50, 60, 70, 80-year-old folks who devote a lot of their time to helping younger folks read, so to speak.
I wanted to get some into what you do at Volunteer Wisconsin. How do you help facilitate volunteering in the state?
Well, we really try to get the word out. We want to make sure that individuals are aware of their volunteer centers in their area. Not every county has a volunteer center, but those that do are very fortunate. Those folks are experts in the field, and they can help out. What we try to do here at Volunteer Wisconsin is focus on areas that don't have volunteer centers. So we have a website. We try to do presentations out in the community for agencies that need volunteerism. For example, I was at the Wisconsin PTA convention this past weekend, talking to volunteer coordinators in their organization. So we just want to promote volunteerism across the state.
I want to talk about the impact of volunteering some. First of all, on the community, how big a difference do volunteers make?
Well, volunteers make a tremendous impact on their community. There are numerous projects that wouldn't be able to move forward within a community without just the sheer effort and hours that a volunteer puts in. I spoke earlier about these Habitat for Humanity projects. Those houses wouldn't get built if it weren't for the volunteer hours.
And then the benefits, the impact on the people themselves, the people who volunteer. How does it change people, improve their lives?
Well, it makes people feel much better about themselves. They're more connected with their community. They feel like they've invested in their community. There's studies that show that, people, you just have a better outlook. Really, that is a plus benefit of doing something you like.
April is almost over. National Volunteer Month is almost over. I imagine you wouldn't tell people to stop looking for volunteer opportunities even though the month is over. What should people be looking for as we go on through the rest of the year?
People should always look for opportunities. Actually, we're very proud that we knew that April was Volunteer Month, but at Marshfield Clinic and Volunteer Wisconsin partnered together to offer what was called the Month of May Service Grants. So we were able to award service grants for the month of May, which is coming up. And so we want people to continue that spirit of April into the month of May and beyond. So there were a lot of projects that applied for the grants, and we're very happy to say that there are going to be many, many more projects going on in May, because Marshfield Clinic and Volunteer Wisconsin were able to fund those grants.
Do you want to leave us with a bit of evangelizing for people to get off the fence and get out and do something?
I won't call it evangelizing, but I will say that we do encourage people to get out and volunteer. Find something that you're passionate about and share that. Share that with your community, and you'll find that your community is going to be better for it.
Matthew, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
That was Matthew Van Est. He is director of Volunteer Wisconsin. April is National Volunteer Month. This coming July marks the 40th birthday of a radio show so well-loved it's become a household name. And it's the inspiration for a feature film, and the man at its helm is now a trusted friend and favorite storyteller in homes across the country. Talking, of course, about Garrison Keillor and A Prairie Home Companion.
In the lead-up to the big 40th birthday anniversary, Keillor has a new book out. It's called The Keillor Reader, and it includes stories, essays, poems, and personal reminiscences. Garrison Keillor will be in Milwaukee on Monday, May 7th at Boswell Books from 5 until 7. Now we talk to the man who's been called the heir to Mark Twain, James Thurber, and E.B. White. Garrison Keillor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So in the first pages of your new collection, you've got a letter included from The New Yorker taking one of your submissions in a kind of apologetic way, but it was good news to you, proof that your life wasn't a waste. And now we've got this new collection filled with your writing, your essays. Looking back, what made you a writer?
I think I became a writer because I couldn't play football. I couldn't pass the physical exam. I had a little click in my heart that the doctor heard, and so I have suffered the terrible disappointment of not putting on shoulder pads and helmet, and I lived in a football town, and that was a big deal. I was in the eighth grade, and instead I went down to the local paper and asked if I could cover football and write about it, and sure, they needed somebody. And so up into the press box I went, and sat up there at the very top of the bleachers, and that felt wonderful. And then on Thursday, I'd go down to the press room and watch Whitey stand on the platform, and he'd lift a big sheet of paper off a stack of newsprint and put it down on the letterpress, and it would go whoosh, chunk, and down into the trimmer, and it trimmed it up, and you picked up this copy of the paper with your words and your name. Your name and you know, hundreds or dozens of readers, you know, waiting to hear your account of Friday night's football game.
Hundreds
That's
or dozens.
That's when I became a writer. Hundreds or dozens or, you know, your
five
aunt.
Or six.
Anyway, yeah, right.
Well, you've got a couple of brand new essays in this book, and I wonder if you'd read from one of them for us. It's the last essay, and it talks about the aspect of cheerfulness. Would you give us a taste?
Cheerfulness. Cheerfulness is a choice. It's like choosing what color socks to wear, the black or the red. Happiness is something that occurs or it doesn't, and don't hold your breath. Joy is a theological idea. It's pretty rare among us mortals. Bliss is brief, about 5 seconds for the male, 15 for the female. Contentment is something that belongs to older cultures. Americans are a hungry, restless people, ever in search of the rainbow, the true source, the big secret. And euphoria is a drug. I found euphoria when I had a wisdom tooth extracted. Those three words, wisdom tooth extracted, that sound like agony to those of us who grew up in the age of pain, when the dentist was a cranky, bug-eyed guy with sour breath who climbed up on your lap with a pair of pliers and wrestled you for the tooth. But now you go to an oral surgeon who asks if you'd like a sedative, and you say, why not? And they pop a needle in the crook of your elbow and usher you into a dreamy phase, and 5 minutes later you wake up and a nurse says, are you okay? My gosh. You haven't been this okay for a long time. You're in this creamy, dreamy state of happy buoyancy wafting high above this world of squalor and misery. There's no hangover, none. This is what my hippie pals were looking for back in the 60s, sitting in candlelight, smoking reefer that smelled like burning asphalt. That was no more effective than smoked trout. It's what I was aiming for when I used to make a martini. Unfortunately, there was a second martini that made me stupid, which is not the same as ecstasy. In any case, I was not brought up to expect ecstasy. Our God was a sober and practical God who appreciated cleanliness and good work habits more than outbursts of overenthusiasm. suffering was an important part of the big picture. Suffering drew us closer to him. One more reason to feel good about living in Minnesota. So, here's a drug to smooth out the rough places on the highway of life. I can hear my ancestors crying, "No, no, 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 no." That's a coward's way of thinking. An intelligent person craves reality over illusion, and the dosages are hard to control. A life of euphoria can easily slide into the life of hibernation. Cheerfulness, on the other hand, is a habit you assume in the morning and hang on to as best you can for the rest of the day. It fails at times, and then it recovers. It's a job. The sour narcissism of others can dent your cheerfulness, or heartbreaking news on the radio, the college boy who left the party drunk and passed out in a snowbank and died, 19, nice kid who did one dumb thing and he's gone. But the cheerful man retains his vim and verve, rises to the occasion, makes people laugh. You can cheerfully endure the deaths of loved ones, a gloomy marriage, a dopey job. You can drive away from a bad luck town and make a fresh start on a new frontier. It's all possible if you maintain your good humor.
Oh, thank you so much for reading that. And you write in the same piece later on, you write that suffering is the ground from which cheerfulness springs. Sounds like something everyone wants to believe after the Midwestern winter that we have just been through in Minnesota and in Wisconsin. What have you learned about cheerfulness over the years?
Well, I've learned that it's the only way to be if you're in the business of radio. I did an early morning shift. That's really where I started out. In radio, was getting up at 4 in the morning and getting to the studio at 5 and going on the air at 6. And when you are on the air with people at 6 o'clock in the morning, a dark vision of life is of no use to you. They don't need that. They have their own. Everybody has their own tragedy, their own gloom they can draw on if they need to. What they need from you is to be cheerful. Lighten up.
We're talking right now with the Prairie Home Companion's Garrison Keillor. He's got a new book out. It's his collected writings, and it's called The Keillor Reader.
And we want to hear from you. Why do you think a Prairie Home Companion struck such a chord with people that it still continues 40 years down the road? Or do you have a question for Garrison Keillor? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
We're back with the Prairie Home Companion's Garrison Keillor right now. He's got a new book of collected writings out, and it's called The Keillor Reader.
And you can join the conversation if you have questions about Garrison Keillor's writing about Prairie Home Companion. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Garrison, in this new collection of your writings, a couple new essays in there, there's some very personal details. At one point, you kind of cop to being a narcissist. Do you think you have to be a narcissist to be a great performer and go on stage like you do?
Did I admit that? Did I really?
You kind of did.
I kind of did.
You did, yeah.
Well, then there must be some truth to it. I mean, a writer is weaving a career out of himself, but each person is frankly of fairly limited interest, and so really what a writer depends on is to be a vacuum cleaner and to listen to other people and to take their stories and put them in his writing. That's what I do more than talking about myself. The news from Lake Wobegon, for example, I very seldom appear in there in the first person. It's almost always about people I know who are carefully disguised.
And writing isn't your main squeeze, it turns out. Even though you've got this book of writing, it turns out the radio seems to be your passion, unsurprisingly. You write, I want to read you a quote from the essay. You write, "Writing a novel is like setting out to hike across Texas. Somewhere around Dallas, you discover you don't really like Texas. You still have 500 miles to go. Doing a weekly radio show is like walking into town to have lunch with your friends. Has doing a radio show always been what felt most like home to you?
Well, I'm a writer. Writing is what I do. It's what I did when I woke up this morning. It's what I will do tonight. You know, it's something you don't need other people's permission to do. You've got to be my age, and publication becomes less important to you than what's immediately in front of you on the screen. A radio show, however, you know, is a big enterprise. A Prairie Home Companion, you know, has an extensive staff that does all of the logistical work and the technical work and makes it sound as good as it does, and musicians and actors and so on. It's a whole complicated team of people. And so I make it sound a little easy in that quote that you read there. It's certainly a lot more complicated than going into town and having lunch with your friends. But you come to 5 o'clock Central Time when the work is done, and that's the part that's fun, when you sing the theme song to Shamingo and you launch into it and you introduce your first guest and you do your first commercial for Bebop Rebop Rhubarb Pie or the Ketchup Advisory Board or the American Duct Tape Council. That's all easy. All the work is done by that point.
I want to go to our phones right now. We have Jackie wanting to talk to you from Drummond. Hi, Jackie.
Oh, fun talking to you, Garrison. My son lives in Japan, and he always tells me when he gets homesick from Minnesota, he tunes into your show on the Internet. So I thought that was really cool. You really have a global influence on people, and thank you so much.
I guess it's cheaper than making a long-distance call, I guess.
Well, no, I'm on Skype, so that works, too. But, yeah, thank you.
So how long can you talk to him on Skype?
Oh, forever and ever and ever. And he
really?
Has a little boy, and so we call, and I, you know, watch him play and read to him. And it's free. I don't understand how Skype is free. But
I don't either.
Yeah,
it just doesn't make sense, does it? So do you feel self-conscious when you're on Skype?
Well, if I get up in the morning and I haven't combed my hair and I have hat hair, but no.
Uh-huh.
No. See, I have to tell you one more thing as long as we're reminiscing
yes.
here.
Right.
Do you remember when you were at the Normandale Community College and you gave us a powder milk biscuit and chicken dinner free along with your show? That was like in 72 or 73.
We had to lure
that?
People in. You know, we had to offer
yeah.
free food. I mean, you know, people wouldn't come just to see me. Yeah, we did the show outdoors. It was under an enormous tree, and people sat on the grass. People like to sit outside so that, you know, if the show slows down, they can look at birds.
Well, Jackie, thanks a lot for calling and sharing your memories. I want to pick up on a strand that Jackie brought up, the Midwestern strand, the Minnesota strand. A Prairie Home Companion has taken you all over the world, all over the country, certainly, and you're a celebrity in your own right, even though you're in public radio. Defying the odds, you're a celebrity in public radio, and yet you're still a good Midwestern boy. What do you do to preserve Midwestern authenticity?
You spend the first 15 years of your life in the Midwest, you will always be a Midwesterner. What you know by the time you're 15, you will always have that, and you're never really going to get away from it. What I didn't realize was that in doing a show, the Midwest is your best choice as a locale for your inventions, for your fiction, for your stories, because those enormous audiences on the left coast and the right coast and the South Coast have never been here. We're a mystery. And so they're fascinated by it. They maybe don't let on, you know, they don't want to seem interested, but they are. People in New York are fascinated by the Midwest. if you should ever move to New York and people ask you where you're from and you say Wisconsin, that's money in the bank. It is. Don't ever put down the Midwest when you're in New York. People love you for it.
Do you think they know what it is, though, or do you think they do have this sort of stylized, folksy, you know, riding in the back of a hay truck idea about what it is to be the Midwest?
Whatever they think the Midwest is, do your best to be that, okay? And even though, you know, even though you've never ridden in the back of a hay truck, make up a story in which you are riding in the back of a hay truck. And if you're my age, then, you know, you can be riding on a hay rack. Drawn by two horses named Brownie and Pete. This is what they want. You know, we're the Midwest. We are the source of true American values. And the new immigrants to our country from Ethiopia, from Somalia, from Southeast Asia, Chinese, they look on the Midwest in the very same way. This is America, the real America. It's right here.
We've got about a minute left. I want to ask you, in your last essay, Cheerfulness, it's about cheerfulness, but it's also about you looking back at your family and what you've learned and what you bring with you. And it's also you looking ahead. And ultimately, your very last lines are about death and how you want to go. But what do you see now as you look ahead at the future, both for Prairie Home Companion and just for yourself?
I think the show will go on for a year or two or maybe more. I have no idea. It's a lot of fun to do it now, and that's all I really ask of it. When I look back, though, I'm 71. I really see my life in a different way. I really see it as a whole series of bad moves interrupted by bursts of irrational good luck. And my advice to people your age is be prepared to be lucky. This is really the secret of life. Stupid good luck, blind good luck. It happens to everybody.
That's encouraging. Well, Garrison, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Veronica.
We've been talking to Garrison Keillor, founder and host of A Prairie Home Companion and the Writer's Almanac. He's the author of 19 books of fiction and humor. His newest is called The Keillor Reader. You can catch him at Boswell Books in Milwaukee on Monday, May 5th from 5 to 7 o'clock.
Coming through that door. It's Saturday and the band is playing. Honey, could we ask for more?
It's spring in Minnesota. That's why they're like that. It's a prairie home.